Globalized Compassion Markets. The only entrepreneur who really matters here, Hillary herself, did extremely well by doing so much good. Companies needing a stiff shot of whitewash fell over one another to enlist in her State Department's crusade for solutions for good. The investment bank Goldman Sachs partnered with the State Department in 2011 to give out business school scholarships to women entrepreneurs from Latin America. The following year, Clinton's old friends at the low-wage retailer Walmart announced a $1.5 million gift to states' Women Entrepreneurship in the Americas program. Exxon was on board, too, helping state to register women-owned businesses in Mexico. The figure of the female third-world entrepreneur, rescued from her unbanked state by Wall Street-backed organizations, mentored by her friends in the American professional class, expressing herself through social media, to this day, it remains among the most cherished daydreams in the land of money. Everyone is infatuated with her, the foundations, the State Department, the corporations. Everyone wants to have his picture taken with her. Everyone wants to partner with everyone else to advance her interests and loan her money. The professional's fantasies blend seamlessly one into another. The ideas promoted by the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Women Project, for example, are not really different from those of Hillary's own Vital Voices Foundation, or Coca-Cola's 5x20 initiative, or even the conscientious statements you find in State Department press releases. People move from one node of this right-thinking world to another, and no one really notices because the relocation signifies no meaningful change. They give one another grants and prizes and named chairs. They extol one another's ideas and books. They appear together with their banker pals on panel discussions in Bali or maybe Davos, and they all come together to fix Haiti, and then to fix Haiti again, and then to fix Haiti yet again. Hillary herself eventually moved from state to the Clinton Foundation, where she presided over a dizzying program of awards for the usual people, grants for some genuinely good causes, and the organizing of great spectacles of virtue like the one I attended in New York, a costly praise-orama featuring many of the same people who worked for her in government. What I concluded from observing all this is that there is a global commerce in compassion, an international virtue circuit featuring people of unquestionable moral achievement like Bono, Malala, Sting, Eunice, Angelina Jolie, and Bishop Tutu, figures who travel the world collecting and radiating goodness. They come into contact with the other participants in this market, the politicians and billionaires and bankers who warm themselves at the incandescent virtue of the world-traveling moral superstars. What drives this market are the buyers. Like Walmart and Goldman Sachs partnering with the State Department, what these virtue consumers are doing is purchasing liberalism offsets, an ideological version of the carbon offsets that are sometimes bought by polluters in order to compensate for the smog they churn out. At the apex of all this idealism stands the Clinton Foundation, a veritable market maker in the world's vast, swirling virtue trade. The former president who stands at its head is, quote, the world's leading philanthropic dealmaker, according to a book on the subject. Under his watchful eye, all the concerned parties are brought together, the moral superstars, the billionaires, and of course the professionals who organize, intone, and advise. Virtue changes hands. Good causes are funded. Compassion is radiated and absorbed. And this is modern liberalism in action, an unregulated virtue exchange in which representatives of one class of humanity ritually forgive the sins of another class, all of it convened and facilitated by a vast army of well-graduated American professionals, their reassuring expertise propped up by bogus social science, while the unfortunate objects of their high and noble compassion sink slowly back into a pre-industrial state. What's missing from this picture? One of the motifs of that Clinton Foundation event I attended on International Women's Day in 2015 was the phrase, "not there," a reference to the women who aren't present in the councils of state or the senior management of powerful corporations. The foundation raised awareness of this problem by producing visuals in which fashion models disappeared from the covers of popular magazines like Vogue, Glamour, Self, and Allure. According to a New York Times story on the subject, the Clinton people had gone to a hip advertising agency to develop this concept so that we would all understand that women were missing from the high-ranking places where they deserved to be. There was an even grander act of erasure going on here, but no clever ad man will ever be hired to play it up. International Women's Day, I discovered when I looked it up, began as a socialist holiday, a sort of second Labor Day on which you were supposed to commemorate the efforts of female workers and the sacrifices of female strikers. It's a vestige of an old form of feminism that didn't especially focus on the problems experienced by women trying to be corporate officers, or the views of some mega-billionaire's wife. However, one of the things we were there in New York to consider was how unjust it was that women were underrepresented in the C-suites of the Fortune 500, and, by implication, how lamentable it was that the United States had not yet elected a woman president. There was no consideration, I mean zero, of the situation of women who work on the shop floors of the Fortune 500 for Walmart or Amazon or any of the countless low-wage employers who make that list sparkle. Working-class American women were simply not there. In this festival of inclusiveness and sweet affirmation, their problems were not considered. Their voices were not heard. Now, Hillary Clinton is not a callous or haughty woman. She has much to recommend her for the nation's highest office. For one thing, her knowledge of Washington. For another, the Republican vendetta against her, which is so vindictive and so unfair that I myself might vote for her in November just to show what I think of it. A third, her completely average Midwestern suburban upbringing, an appealing political story that is the opposite of her technocratic image. And she has, after all, made a great effort in the course of the last year to impress voters with her feelings for working people. But it's hard, given her record, not to feel that this was only under pressure from primary opponents to her left. Absent such political force, Hillary tends to gravitate back to a version of feminism that is a straight synonym of meritocracy, that is concerned almost exclusively with the struggle of professional women to rise as high as their talents will take them. No ceilings. As I sat there in the Best Buy theater, however, I kept thinking about the infinitely greater problem of no floors. On the train to New York that morning, I had been reading a book by Peter Adelman, one of the country's leading experts on welfare and a former friend of the Clintons. Adelman's aim was to document the effect that the Clintons' welfare reform measure had on poor people, specifically on poor women, because that's who used to receive welfare payments in the days before the program was terminated. Adelman was not a fan of the old pre-1996 welfare system because it did nothing to prepare women for employment or solve the problem of daycare. But under the old system, at least our society had a legal obligation to do something for these people, the weakest and most vulnerable among us. Today, thanks to Hillary and her husband, that obligation has been canceled and we do almost nothing. The result, Adelman maintains, has been exactly what you'd expect. Extreme poverty has increased dramatically in this country since Bill Clinton signed welfare reform in 1996. For poor and working-class American women, the floor was pulled up and hauled off to the landfill some 20 years ago. There's no State Department somewhere to pay for their cell phones or pick up their daycare expenses. And one of the people who helped to work this deed was the very woman I watched present herself as the champion of the world's downtrodden femininity. Sitting there in gilded Manhattan, I thought of all the abandoned factories and post-industrial desolation that surround this city, and I mused on how, in such places, the old Democratic Party was receding into terminal insignificance. It had virtually nothing to say to the people who inhabit that land of waste and futility. But for the faithful liberals at the Clinton Foundation gathering in New York, none of that mattered. The party's deficit in relevance to average citizens was more than made up by its massive surplus in moral virtue. Here, inside the theater, the big foundations and the great fashion magazines were staging a pageant of goodness unquestionable, and the liberal class was swimming happily in its home element. They knew which things were necessary to make up a liberal movement, and all of the ingredients were present: well-meaning billionaires, grant-makers and grant recipients, Hollywood stars who talked about social media, female entrepreneurs from the third world, and, of course, a trucked-in audience of hundreds who clapped and cheered enthusiastically every time one of their well-graduated leaders wandered across the screen of the Jumbotron. The performance of liberalism was so realistic one could almost believe it lived.